This is Chatter on Books, because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call her, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. We might have a really busy evening this evening, or we might not, because Hannah Depp Oliver may or may not be joining us. It is great to have everybody with us. And a little bit later, we are going to be talking with Chris Whipple. And many of the people listening to the show have read Chris Whipple's last book, which was called The Gatekeepers, which is an amazing book about the White House chiefs of staff and the critical role they play in everything. And now he has a fabulous book out called The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History in the Future. Really interesting, a terrific read, as Larry King would say. And hopefully we'll be talking a little bit with Hannah Depp Oliver. And some time ago, pre-pandemic, we went over to Loyalty Books in Silver Spring and spent some time with Hannah Depp Oliver about the great stuff she was doing in the community there. Hannah, among all the other things she's doing these days, was tapped to be a judge for the National Book Awards. So we're going to talk to her about that. Most importantly, joining me tonight, Tori Clark, we've got Claude Jennings doing all the important stuff. We've got David Aldrich, who's dealing with the draft tonight, so he may or may not be with us.
I'm here.
And welcome back to our Chatter on Books alum, Lewis Byard, which rhymes with tired. Which
everyone's tired, wired, whatever existential state you're in.
I guess say
it rhymed mired, wired, whatever.
Yeah, and, Baird. Yeah. Baird has but, a more noble sound to it. I think you the pronunciation.
You think? Yeah. Name. Well, yes, and it can also mean a bay-colored horse.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah. A mythical bay-colored horse that can change its size according to the number of riders.
Wow. Riders plural.
I did some research on that. Lewis, how are you? And how's the
Why
pandemic?
Are you doing? Why are you doing research, Tori, about?
Well, because I was a little flummoxed about not pronouncing your name correctly. So then I thought I'll try to learn something. How's the pandemic treating you? You look healthy.
I do. Yes, I have no lower body. Just
who does?
This is all I've got.
Are you wearing pants?
It's none of your business if I'm wearing pants or not.
It's kind really, of a typical Zoom question.
It's really none of your business. So I'm just saying.
It is. Are you writing anything during the pandemic?
I am. I am finishing a book about Jack and Jackie Kennedy, their little courtship, which began in Washington, D.C. In 1952.
So have you sat in that little tiny booth in Martin's where they claimed they were dating?
No, I think that's I think that's a lie. I don't think
it is. I don't think it's for real.
You think what you want to think. Well, actually, one of the things that's amazed me during the research is this has all happened within living memory, right? Like people, yes. There are people alive who were alive then. And you still can't find historians who will agree on when they met, where they met, why, who was there when they met. It's kind of astonishing to me that we can't nail that stuff down. Yeah,
because that was considered one of the all-time marriages of the 20th century. Sorry,
the all-time somethings. The all-time somethings. Yeah, for sure. So yeah.
Are you watching the latest season of The Crown? Have you been?
Of course I am. Of course I am awesome. Watching the. Oh my gosh! Right. Yeah, no, I love it. I love Gillian Anderson as Margaret Thatcher, and it's just terrific. And funny, it's to a point where we all remember, right?
Sure.
Charles and Diana, we remember that whole craziness.
I was working at the Washington Star when Charles and Diana got married, and of course it was 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, but it was the media event of the century.
Right.
And absolutely.
And people had to work on covering it for the Star, showed up at the newsroom, wearing top hats, and they'd grab a morning coat, and people brought bottles of champagne. It was insane. So, Lewis, speaking of royalty, a couple of weeks ago, David and I had the pleasure of talking to David Reynolds, this epic author, historian, who had written, his book is Abraham Lincoln in His Time.
Oh, nice.
1,200 pages of serious
pounds is better.
Pounds is better. It was 1,200 pounds, too. I have it here somewhere. Hold on. It's
oh my God! Don't hurt yourself. Don't.
Yeah, look. I mean, it's very heavy. The entire time we were talking to him, and the whole time Dave and I are texting each other, going, "Wow, this guy is smart. This guy is smart." I kept wanting to ask him about courting Mr. Lincoln, and I just kept thinking about speed and going, "I really wanted to hear more about that."
Yeah,
he didn't delve into that aspect of age.
Well, there was only so much time you had with him. I'm sure. I'm sure he would have gone there. He would have gone there. I'm sure.
There was 45 minutes of serious with him. He sent me a really nice email the next day, not a handwritten thank you note, so he will not be asked back on. He sent me a really nice email the next day saying something along the lines of, really nice to join you and David in a, how shall I say it, unusual book show. Thank you very much.
It's because we were drunk. I mean, you know.
Not till the end of the show.
Not till the end, exactly. The end.
So, okay.
So much judgment going on, right?
Oh, yeah. There she is, Hannah. How are you? Hi, Anne.
I am great. We are packaging up the Obama book in the store tonight to ship out it.
Excellent. I've got a question about that. But first, I have to give David a hard time about something. So, yes. David, I'm on my phone. I'm going to The Athletic, and I'm looking at all the headlines on The Athletic for Monday. And something seems to be missing. The Steelers having their best season ever.
Let's see.
We've got a nice catch that you and Lewis were gushing over earlier.
Uh-huh. Right.
I got to scroll way down.
The Cardinals.
In The Athletic, yeah. I have to scroll down through somebody's prison conviction before
I can I'm sorry. What part of The Athletic are you looking at?
The part that is like the David Aldridge curated section.
Which, I mean, is that the DC section? Is that what you're talking about?
This is called my front page. I got the Thunder trade. I've got some COVID stuff. I got Drew Brees. I got NCAA.
It says your front page, right?
Yes.
Your front page is whatever you want to read about. And so you can make your own front page.
I think it's pretty obvious what I want to talk about, David.
Okay. Will you stop your mansplaining, David?
Jeez. Yeah, exactly. Same problem.
Right, Jesus.
You're right.
Same problem 2 weeks ago when the Steelers were 8-0.
Okay.
They're 9-0.
We're not, there's no conspiracy tour. They're on, if you go to the cities, on the top, there's a part that says cities. And you scroll down to Pittsburgh and you click Pittsburgh and there's nothing but Steelers on the Pittsburgh front page.
I shouldn't have to scroll anywhere. It should be like,
I just told you to put whatever teams you want on your front page.
Tori doesn't scroll. She doesn't do that. She doesn't.
Okay. Let's go to better topics.
I love that. Tori doesn't scroll. I love that.
I don't. Okay.
Nothing good happens after midnight. Tori doesn't scroll.
Ever. Okay. Okay, we're back with Hannah Depp Oliver. We are so happy to have her with us. Owner of Loyalty Books, started out in Petworth, moved to Silver Spring where we've been. Great place, great center of the community in Silver Spring. And Hannah, I know you've got a tight schedule, so we'll make this fast. But I know the last time we talked with you, it was the beginning of the pandemic. You were getting really good at packing and shipping, which you did not be part of local independent bookseller, but you're getting really good at that. How's the pandemic treating you? How are your customers doing? And how are you dealing with the Barack Obama memoir?
This is publishing week. This is like the, we just had the Kirkus Prize. We now have the National Book Award in a couple of days. We have the Booker in a few days. We've got Obama dropping his book. It's a juggernaut of a week for sure. I think everybody's just like they've ordered extra coffee for the back rooms. You know, they're really ready to go. Literally they sent the message out that there was going to be a special holiday drop in for this book, that it was volume one of the president's memoirs. And we pretty much immediately sent out a social media blast and an email to our customers within, I think, about an hour saying, hi, you're going to want to pre-order this book because the one thing that has been truly consistent throughout the pandemic is that the crisis that a lot of booksellers were talking about in the last couple of years, among the many things that we are canaries in the coal mine for, we were seeing hold up in print runs for some time. We were like, you know, there's less and less printers and binderies in the U.S. There's less and less paper, literally paper production in the U.S., and we were worried about shortages and what that supply chain was going to look like as it kept moving abroad. And then turns out a global pandemic is really a time that you're going to have to reckon with that. So, you guys might've seen the thing that the president's book is printed in Germany and shipped over here because that was the only place they could get, you know, the printing press. It's really wild. It's really, really forcing the industry to reckon with how we literally physically make these objects that we all treasure so much.
And I'm guessing sales have been brisk of his book.
Yeah. It turns out people really want to know what Obama has to say about a lot of things. So that's been, I mean, you know, I'm not mad at it. I mean, I love a Q4 sales boost. It's also a little bit crazy because it means that we know that basically there's not going to be a lot of restocks of books. The issues that we saw over the summer with slowdowns at the post office haven't actually been resolved just because we've got a different president-elect now, right? So, you know, we're still facing these long shipping times, both to get books to us and then to get books back out to the customers. We have the most, I say this unabashedly, we have a loyal customer base here at Loyalty. And it's been, frankly, incredible. There's, you know, six of us working semi round the clock in different shifts, some remotely and some physically in the store, just answering emails, answering social media DMs, shipping books, processing web orders. We were at one point, you know, a full like 2 months behind between what we could not get because physically there weren't enough copies in the US yet for anti-racist reading over the summer. And then also the sudden volume, because we got put on, you know, Oprah's list of black owned bookstores in the US, you know, things that are just like the greatest.
Oprah,
gift of
she's the best.
It turns out, a lot of people like to follow what Oprah says.
who knew?
It went from being, it's still a very disconnected feeling because it's literally like the best gift anyone's ever given you. Mm-hmm. Coupled at the time when like you literally cannot meet the demand because the industry has ground to a halt.
Yeah. I'd be willing to bet that those people who support you and love you and appreciate what you do forgive mistakes. They might forgive it takes, God forbid, 3 days to get a book instead of one. Yeah. Those kinds of things.
Right? Yeah, it's really funny. Our community has been incredible. So patient, so lovely. I will say it's really funny. There's a lot of people who were like, oh, I've suddenly heard of this thing called shopping local or supporting Black business over the summer. Yeah. And they didn't, you know, it's been a really interesting time. We've gotten a lot of, you know, we've had a wide variety of messages from incredibly wonderful people being like, I don't care how long it takes, you know, it's going to be fine. To folks, you know, calling us lazy and saying we were running a scam, which is hilarious. Like, worst scam ever, guys.
Worst scam ever.
But you know, it's those people are obviously, you know, they might spoil your day or your hour, but they're not the majority at all. And it's just been, it's been really incredible. It's you know, we are in our community and around our community in a way I thought it would take years for us to build, because you know, we've just been trying to be as engaged as we can on social, on our website.
Sure.
In our inbox, and you know, talking to people on the ground doing the same thing like y'all, that we're just all trying to stay as connected as we can when we can't see each other. You know, you build a physical space so you can talk to people about books and hand them a book. And when you can't hand them a book anymore, then it becomes how do I talk to you with this much enthusiasm?
Right. Remotely. Okay. And you're going 24/7 and you're doing all these things that you never thought your business would have to do. How do you have time to be a judge for the National Book Awards?
Yes.
How do you get tapped to be a judge for the National Book Awards? Because we're offering our services.
And I think you should probably send it. You should be like, hello, we're amazing. FYI.
And have you been bribed? Has anybody tried to bribe you yet?
No one is trying to bribe me, and I'm frankly offended.
Right?
There has never been a time I've been more susceptible to bribing than right now. I'm so tired. I would be very open to it.
I take a bottle of wine.
Right, exactly. Send me a nice whiskey. I'm yours. Yeah. this is the kind of thing that was actually on my goal list for my career that I thought would take another 10 or 15 years to accomplish. So I had been tapped to serve as a conversation partner last year. The National Book Award picks an author from their National Book Award history. It's a new program started by Lisa Lucas and Team Book that they're going to spend the year discussing. And so in 2019, it was James Baldwin, you know, great choice. There's so much to unpack there. So I had two different conversations with two different sets of authors who are also themselves National Book Award nominees to discuss James Baldwin. And those conversations, I think, sort of brought me into the National Book Award attention. And the other thing that I would say, my truest skill is that I can read like a mofo. I mean,
that's what I want to ask you about. I'm a slow reader. Tori also reads like a mofo. I need hints. I'm still a slow reader after all these years. I'm slow.
I don't find
good career reading. Choice, Lewis. Good career choice.
Yeah, right. I joke and I'm like,
absorb.
There's you know, people always joke about like, what are you going to do with your humanities degree? And I'm like, well, I can read really fast. and I'm a very basic logic is my friend. So I do think that I'm able to read, understand the essence and essential part of the book. And with judging, it's really okay, I'm going to read 100 pages of this and then I'm going to move on if it's not working.
You don't read the whole book if it's not working.
No, I joked because I am one of those nerds who tracks their reading on a spreadsheet. And I was like, I've read 60 to, you know, 200 pages of over 600 books this year for the National Book Award.
Wow.
But like, then which ones did I finish? Right. You know, it's a very strange thing to do. And if you're, you know, a book lover, you're like, but this poor little baby, it's not for me, but maybe it's for someone, you know. You have to kill your darlings a little bit. You have to.
I would give it 10 pages. I would give it 10 pages or 20. Like, how many pages do you really give it?
Really, my minimum is 60, unless 60? It's just god awful, which, you know, things don't get submitted. It might not be. The other thing is that it might not be right for the project of the National Book Award, but it might still be a great book. So honestly, it was actually like, as a bookstore owner, I go through hundreds of upcoming released and backlist catalogs to look for things that match what Loyalty is trying to do in the community to bring in here for stock. So it was actually like kind of an extension of that almost.
All those arcs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Chatter on Books connections with the National Book Awards, we have Hannah, the judge, and Frank Wilderson of Afro-Pessimism, which is long listed.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And such a good book.
He was, I don't want to make the connection too precisely here, but he was long listed for the National Book Awards just a couple of weeks after he was on Chatter on Books.
I think it speaks for itself.
I'm just saying, the evidence is out there. It's out in the world. Yeah. You just put it out there.
So you can't tell us who won, can you?
I cannot tell you. It's a very funny thing too. I had, you know, it's an extremely intimate experience with four other strangers that you never would have met before.
Right.
You know, Terry Tempest Williams' cell phone like number is in my phone now. Like, what world am I living in? Like, what's happening? It's such an intense, weird process. And you just talk to these people for hours as you go through the pros and cons, and you can't help but be vulnerable. And it's a really special connection that you make with your fellow judges. And we all have such variant tastes and backgrounds. I will say that's been the strength, I think, of all the many great things Lisa Lucas has done. And I'm so excited for her to have be heading up a publication house, you know, in the next year. But what she's done for the National Book Award, I think, is bring some of the most diverse, in the fullest sense of that word, divergent judges together who have created really interesting long and short lists as a result, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't want to put you on the spot about who wins, but
also loses.
Right.
Yeah, but I can tell you, no,
everyone.
Everyone lost. I picked no one.
Of the nine people listening to Chatter and Books, I promise no one will tell. to you, Hannah, and to you, Lewis, so let's take it out of the National Book Award, the Booker Award, which is also this week.
Booker, yeah.
And Donald Stewart, Shuggie Bain, has also said, like Oliver Mabel, I'm a little more excited about Oliver Mabel, has agreed to be on Chatter and Books, but wanted to push
very
it back
cool.
to Book Awards. The thing about the Booker Awards, and I want to get your opinion, Hannah, and your opinion, Lewis. The Booker Awards, what they said about this year was so many debut novelists. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the tried and true. It wasn't the authors that we've read and loved for years. There were an extraordinary number of debut novelists. How do you feel about debut novelists being nominated for such a prestigious prize? Hannah first, then Lewis.
Oh, come on. I feel great about it. I do think we're at a moment, you know, we go through this maybe every 20 years or so in publishing where there's kind of a changing of the guard, not in that, like, it's not like we don't want to hear what, you know, Donna Tartt has to say, but at one point she was the debut novelist, right? And so I think you have a really fantastic list, especially for fiction, on pretty much all of the prizes this year. There's at least two debut novelists, I believe. And I think we're just getting this incredibly strong cast of writers who, whether or not I loved their first book that I'm reading, I cannot wait to see what they do next. And it's an interesting thing with a prize, but a prize essentially assures some level of secondary payday that will get you at least another book, right? Yeah. And yeah. So we can argue about whether or not the Booker should be that thing that gives you that. I think there are some other prizes that are more obviously designed for that gift. But I really want to make sure that all of those people, whether, you know, it's Maga Mengesti or Brandon Taylor, like I want them to do more. So I'm just so excited. And I'm also excited for them to reach an international audience too, because America is just very tiny publishing world. So.
Right. Gotcha. Lewis?
Where's the love for the middle-aged journeyman who's been
debuts are written by 20-year-olds, guys. Debuts, your debut novel can come when you're 50.
I'm going to skew it all there, Lewis.
I think it's great. What I run the Penn Faulkner Award thing, and I'm not a judge though because I'm too slow. But one of the things I do find the awards are so. They're so personal. They're so personal to the judges who are reading those books that year. So you get a completely different slate depending on who's reading them. And because we all bring our own particular tastes and predilections and experiences to them. So that's why I love the proliferation of this stuff. I love the fact that the National Book Award will be different from the Penn Faulkner, from the Pulitzer, from the Booker. Not always. Sometimes there is some weird convergence that happens, but it's always when they diverge that I think it becomes really interesting and useful.
My gut tells me, and we talked a little bit about this a few weeks ago, I can't remember what context, but the pandemic has allowed the judges of all these different awards. I've got just an antipathy to awards because I've never received any, but I think the pandemic has allowed, it's given people time to think a little bit more, about what they're reading. You know, Hannah's not 60 pages notwithstanding. But it's allowed people to think a little bit more. And I think it'll be really interesting 10, 15, 20 years from now to look back and say, what were the books we were really pointing to? Mm-hmm. What was the writing we were really looking to?
Mm-hmm. I will tell you, we can't talk a lot about, but I will tell you that is definitely, while I have never had less time, I think a lot of people are, just at home and they're reading more than ever, which is great. But I do think that we have thought, like, what are the books that are an answer to this moment that we find ourselves in, this like incredible moment in history.
Yes.
So I really do think that has influenced a lot. Like, looking at what people have picked, I'm like, wow, that's clearly a response to this moment.
Awesome. Okay. I have to be responsive and responsible to Hannah's time. She has to go. Hannah, what's the best way for people to support Loyalty Books right now?
You can make a shopping appointment in our downtown Silver Spring store, or if you're in our Petworth neighborhood, you can do some window shopping with us. You can do that right on loyaltybookstores.com. If you want something shipped, we also have a bookshop.org page. So check that out as well. You can search via your zip code. You can just search for Loyalty Books on there. If you are a member or you want to become a member of Loyalty, you can do that right on our front page, loyaltybookstores.com.
Awesome. Hannah, thank you so much. We know you're going 24/7, so I so appreciate your being here.
Thank you. I love you guys so much. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
All you do for our Silver Spring book nerds.
All right. We love you. Take care. Bye, honey.
Bye.
Bye. Okay. Chris Whipple, you're still awake?
I'm here.
Excellent.
Riveted.
Thanks. You probably had.
You weren't riveted. It's okay, sir. It's all right.
Oh, Hannah's amazing.
She's great.
And one of the things we talked about and I think David, you might have missed the first time we went to her store in Silver Spring.
I think so. Yeah.
Some important work about the NBA draft or
something
like that
going on. Yeah.
But one of the things we talked about at the time was this is pre-pandemic, and one of the great things about local independent bookstores is they had become these incredible heartbeats in their local communities. And the time at which technology was taking over everybody's lives, and they wanted human interaction. They wanted to come in and get somebody's advice on the book to buy for their husband or their daughter or their whomever. And they wanted to have their book club meet in the bookstore because it was nicer to be with real people. And they were becoming this very human interaction. And then the flip, and so local independent bookstores were coming back and becoming more successful. And then the flipping pandemic hit and turned the whole thing upside down. And I mean, really, Hannah, the last time we talked to her, we talked about, I never understood shipping and packing and things like that. And she's become an expert at it, but she's remarkable.
A whole new set of job skills that bookstore employees are having to do now. Yeah. It's amazing.
And she and her employees literally have been on shifts, like on call, because they never want to miss an email. They never want to miss a text. Remarkable. Okay, now we're going to talk with Chris Whipple. Chris, it is so nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Great to meet you.
What do you want? Award-winning author, documentarian, commentator?
Whatever works for you.
All right. Many people who are listening to this show, Chatter and Books, do know Chris wrote a wonderful book called The Gatekeepers, which is about White House Chiefs of Staff, who I've always been fascinated with White House Chiefs of Staff. I've known some White House Chiefs of Staffs. It is a great book. And now he's turned his sights on the heads of the CIA. It's called The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. And one of the things that struck me, Chris, listening to a lot of the interviews that you've done thus far in this book, is the number of people, and they're so pretentious when they say it, people interview going, well, actually, this was a surprisingly interesting read. They expected it to be some really heavy duty look into the CIA heads. And so I think they were a little offensive about your writing, which is terrific. But by way of introduction for you, we're going to do CIA 101. And that is, the CIA world is divided into analysts and operatives, largely. So tell us, those of us who are quasi newbies to the CIA, the difference between analysts and operatives, and which one would you be? And by the way, I'm not completely convinced you're not a spy. So,
well, first of all, thanks for having me on. And I do expect to be shortlisted now for the National Book Award.
Absolutely. By the Chatter on Books.
It's done.
I understand. So I got really lucky with the CIA director's book because it's a cast of characters that you just couldn't dream up. I mean, before we get to analysts and operatives and the difference between the two, my book begins with Richard Helms, who is this incredible character, dry martini in one hand, cigarette in the other, who could walk into the Oval Office and tell LBJ that bombing North Vietnam would have the opposite effect of driving them to the negotiating table. And then fast forward all the way to Gina Haspel, who's this incredible mystery woman, the first to run the CIA, who cut her teeth as a covert operative in Africa and rose to the top. But you're right. The CIA director runs an army of analysts, covert operatives, paramilitary warriors, and lethal drones. But essentially, it comes down to two camps, the analysts and the covert operatives. And they're two completely separate worlds, or always have been traditionally. They literally used to eat in separate cafeterias at Langley, and they never really interacted whatsoever. The analysts tend to be intellectual, sun-deprived. the joke about analysts is, do you want to know if an analyst is extroverted? Well, he looks at your shoes. And of course, the operatives are, this unbelievably extroverted, daring, unbelievably courageous characters who, Mike Morrell once said to me that, the covert operatives the only way you can get them to do to perform is to tell them that you love them, because when they go out, it takes unbelievable courage to try to talk people into betraying their country. I had a great time researching the book and talking to analysts and operatives alike.
So which one is Chris Whipple? If you were going to be, let's pretend for a minute you're not a spook. Hate the word, but if you were an analyst, would you be an analyst or would you be an operative?
You'd have to want to be an operative. I mean, it's really not, for me, it's not even close. I mean, if you have a choice between, parachuting into Africa and meeting with hard targets and back alleys and trying to talk them into betraying their country, or spending most of your time in a library analyzing data. For me, that's an easy choice. But
I choose the latter one, by the way. I choose the latter part.
Yeah. James Bond or Jack Ryan? This is a tough choice. I don't know.
I choose the latter. Yeah. Libraries are nice. They're comfortable.
And safe. Very safe.
It's safe, right? Yeah.
You don't have to jump out of anything.
Yeah, no jumping. There's no jumping.
And it's interesting because there have been operatives who have risen to the top who have become CIA directors, and there have been analysts as well. And there's no formula. There's, some operatives have crashed and burned, and some analysts have succeeded, and vice versa. But anyway, it's one of the things I try to do. And here's a spoiler alert for people who have read The Gatekeepers. Some of the attributes that make great White House chiefs of staff also serve CIA directors well. So it's no coincidence that Leon Panetta was the gold standard in both jobs, in my opinion. And he knew very little about intelligence, but he was one of these people who could, he was grounded, he was confident, he'd been around the block, and he could tell Barack Obama what he didn't want to hear.
Right.
And that's the most important thing.
I have so many questions for you from the book, The Spy Masters. It's fabulous. But let's start with this. One of the common themes throughout the book, or anybody who knows anything about CIA directors, the cliche about them is they're the person that has to tell the president what he, soon she, will not want to hear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But throughout the book, from Helms to Pompeo and Haspel, about whom we don't know much because they didn't talk to you, which was a mistake in my opinion. It's ups and downs. Sometimes they did tell the president what the president didn't want to hear. Sometimes they held back. But talk about that's the most important trait. And I agree with you. It's the most important trait about chiefs of staff of any organization, including the White House. You need to be able to tell the president what he doesn't want to hear. But talk about that. And who do you think of all the CIA directors you covered in this book, and you talked to all of them, the living ones, except for Pompeo and Haspel, who did it well and who didn't do it well?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's an almost impossible balancing act because the CIA director has to, on the one hand, tell the president hard truths. And on the other, he or she has to have the president's ear. Again, you run this organization with analysts and covert operatives and paramilitary warriors and all the rest, but the whole enterprise is for naught if you don't have the president's ear. If you don't have a seat at the table, you're wasting your time. And CIA directors have been, the results have been mixed. I mean, Dick Helms was the quintessential CIA director. Old school, James Bond-like. Bob Gates described him to me as this Bondian character. But Helms was, Helms was hardly an angel. I mean, he was, when LBJ demanded that Helms come up with intelligence implicating the anti-Vietnam War protesters in the United States, with the communists, with foreign communist powers, Helms went along with it. He obviously thought that he had no choice. He obviously thought that he had to produce something to satisfy Helms. So he wound up launching Operation MH Chaos, which was not only a violation of the CIA's charter, but illegal. It was domestic surveillance. On the other hand, when it really came to crunch time, when Richard Nixon demanded that Helms participate in the Watergate cover-up by calling off the FBI investigation, Helms drew the line and arguably saved the CIA, upheld the rule of law, and sank the Nixon administration. So he's a fascinating character. And
was he your favorite?
He was one of my favorites, but one of my favorite interviews, if not the favorite, was with his widow, Cynthia Helms, who sadly died in the summer of 2019. But I spent a lot of time with her, and she was 95 years old and just
wow,
just a pistol, just really sharp. Yeah. full of untold stories, including the one. And, you know, I try to humanize the directors. I hope the Spine.
You succeeded.
I hope very it much so. Yeah. With that. So my favorite stories are the ones when Cynthia Helms talks about Dick Helms coming home at the end of the day and telling her that he had lash marks on his back, figuratively, not literally, from Bobby Kennedy hectoring him to get rid of Fidel Castro by fair means or foul.
Right.
We know how that worked out.
Yeah. You know, one long veteran CIA operative told me, you know, don't ask the CIA to assassinate people because we were just really bad at it.
Let's talk about Cynthia for a minute, because one of the things that struck me when I read the book, and there really are fantastic stories. There's new reporting in this book, things we've never known of before. And one that struck me is you're writing about people who were tasked with guarding some of the most important secrets ever, but they, and in many cases their spouses and some around them, seem very eager to talk with you. How did you do it?
I don't know.
Massive amounts of alcohol? Did you just like liquor them up? And
Cynthia, I'm not sure anybody had paid much attention to Cynthia Helms in a few years. And
she was great.
And she was just full of great stories, including the one about the study that Helms commissioned on his own authority into the domino theory, which was the strategic basis for the Vietnam War.
Right.
And of course, he came back with this conclusion that it was really a bunch of malarkey, as Joe Biden would say. And LBJ didn't want to hear about it and deep sixed the report, according to Cynthia. But it surfaced later on. Bob McNamara, the former defense secretary, found it. It had been declassified, picks up the phone, calls Helms. Cynthia answers the phone, and he proceeds to chew her out, saying, why wasn't I shown this? This could have made a difference. Anyway, I mean, just she was full of great stories like that. Mm. One of the things I found, you know, when you go into a book like this, I think I naively thought that certain stuff would be classified that nobody could talk about.
Right.
The rest would be fair game. And so go for it. What I discovered was that it really depended on the director you were talking to at any given time. So for example, nobody's gonna tell Leon Panetta or Bob Gates or George Tenet what they can talk about and what they can't. Right. There was no CIA minder in the room with me. There was no review board looking over my manuscript when I turned it in. And so what it all came down to was who was willing to, you know, cross the line. And so David Petraeus, for example, I asked him about so-called signature strikes, which are drone strikes on suspected terrorists who are unidentified, but you think they're bad guys. And Petraeus practically jumped out of his chair and ran out of the room. Mike Hayden, on the other hand, sat there and talked all day about it and explained to me what the theory of signature strikes was, theory and practice and so forth. It depended on what, you know, who was in the chair.
Yeah. One of the things also going through the book, you'd read story after story, again, great original reporting, a lot of this. And I was like, oh my gosh, the world has forgotten about that. Aldrich Ames. So again, we're talking about an agency that is tasked with tackling some of the most difficult problems in the world with the greatest secrecy. And they have this incredible vulnerability. They don't see the person within. They don't see the mole. So remind us of Aldrich Ames and his lasting impacts on the CIA.
So the two most famous moles probably in American intelligence history were Kim Philby,
right,
back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And that's a fantastic story. Philby, of course, befriended James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of the infamous head of counterintelligence for the CIA, and completely betrayed him and wound up sending many CIA assets to their deaths in the Soviet Union.
Many, as in a dozen or more, right?
Yeah, and
torture. Interrogation, torture, and death, correct?
Yeah. And I found myself, and this was well before I started the book, one night I was in the Willard Hotel at a fancy dinner party, and I found myself seated next to this tiny 90-year-old woman. And I turned to her and I introduced myself and asked her who she was. And she said, Mrs. James Jesus Angleton.
Wow.
The Angleton's widow. And I said, oh, my God, you must have known Kim Philby. And she paused and said, well, evidently not well enough.
Oh, awesome. Wow. Anyway, I bet that wasn't the first time she used that line, but it was a great line.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Now, fast fabulous forward to Aldrich Ames. In 1985, CIA agents within the Soviet Union began disappearing mysteriously. And no one could figure out what was going on, but it was obviously one of two things. It was either a communications penetration of CIA communications. Somebody was figuring out the Soviets had penetrated it, or there was a mole. Well, it took nearly 7 or 8 years for the CIA finally to track down the mole. It turned out to be Aldrich Ames, who was a disgruntled CIA officer who should have been obvious. I mean, he was driving a Jaguar into the Langley parking lot every morning.
Alcoholic.
And clearly living way beyond his means, had paid for his house in cash. Anyway, and you know, was a binge drinker. None of this raised any red flags because for some reason, the CIA was asleep at the switch. But anyway, he was revealed in 1994, and essentially that was the end of the career of Bill Clinton's first CIA director, James Woolsey. Woolsey, he was exposed on Woolsey's watch, and Woolsey was gone shortly thereafter. But my favorite story about moles was Bob Gates's first week on the job as CIA director. He invited Dick Helms, you know, the legend, to come and have lunch with him and give him advice. Helms walked through the state of the world and intelligence gathering. And at the end of the lunch, Helms turned to Gates and said one more thing. Never go home at night without wondering where the mole is.
Oh.
And at that moment, unbeknownst to Gates, Aldrich Ames was at work.
And he was caught by the FBI, right?
Well, there are various theories about how Ames was ultimately exposed. But there was a CIA, joint CIA-FBI task
force, okay,
including a number of women who ultimately ran him down.
And am I imagining this, or did I experience it and I've just forgotten? There was a lot of debate and discussion within the government about prosecuting him. And do we go for the death penalty? Am I right about that?
I think you are right about that.
Yeah, because I think I remember, again, it's all a haze fueled by beer.
I have to check a story with you, Tori, because one of the very brief stories I tell in the book is how when George W. Bush came in, Don Rumsfeld was measuring the drapes of the CIA director's office.
Oh, I think that's completely wrong.
And he was going to be CIA director.
Yeah, I think that's completely wrong. On some dark days at the Pentagon, a lot of us wished that he had been made director of the CIA.
Because, as I understand it, both of George W.'s first choice, I mean, his first and second choice as Secretary of Defense, refused to do it.
Yeah.
And Rumsfeld, of course, had spent the whole transition talking about what he would do if he became Secretary of Defense. And that was how suddenly Rumsfeld wound up running DOD.
Yeah. Here's what I find wrong with that. The reason 43 was talking to him at all was because the work he had done before on missile defense and all these other things. And Rumsfeld had started beating the drums about these asymmetrical threats that we were facing. And it was in this broad sense. And I'm not saying Rumsfeld wouldn't have wanted the CIA job, but the thing that really doesn't ring true for me, there was nobody who cared less about superficial things like drapes than Don Rumsfeld. Nothing.
Someone else. Well, let's put it this way. Someone else was measuring the drapes for him.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That person wouldn't have stayed with him for For very long.
I love when you two fight. I love it. Exactly.
I love it too.
Here, I'll tell you a story about how unsuperficial it was, and I'll try to make this quick. So I am the proud traveler of Uzbekistan 4 times. Most people in their lives never go to Uzbekistan. I went at least 3 or 4 times with Rumsfeld. And he would always try, when he visited the Secretary of Defense, he always tried to downplay the exchange of gifts because it was ridiculous, right? But he always tried to downplay it. The other countries often would upplay it. So we go to Uzbekistan the first time, and it's the formal meeting, him and the Minister of Defense for Uzbekistan, and they present him with this beautiful bathrobe-like garment. And it's made out of multicolored tapestry. It looked like something Walt Disney must have invented. It had a great hat that went with it as well. And so they give it to him. They insist he puts it on. He puts it on. They take pictures. He puts the hat on. I laugh. They take pictures. David Kennerly. Oh my God, Chris, we cannot finish the show without talking about Kennerly. David Kennerly took some pictures. They put it back in the box. Off we go. We go back to Uzbekistan a few months later. It was as if he had never been there before. They present him again with a coat and the hat and the same thing. Third time, same thing. And this time, the coat's on. We're ready to wrap it up, put it in the box, and head out. And as we head out to the motorcade, Rumsfeld keeps the coat on. And by the way, this thing is beautiful. He keeps it on. We walk outside of the building. He's getting in his car. There are lots of people standing on the streets like, this is great. U.S. Secretary of Defense is here. And I'm thinking to myself, isn't he kind and being thoughtful and showing his appreciation for the Uzbeks that he's wearing this incredible traditional garb?
Yeah.
Get in his car, and I look at him. I go, what's with the coat anyhow? And he kind of pulls the flaps of the coat aside, and his pants leg was worn all the way through. There was a big hole in his pants leg. Because like a lot of guys, well, nobody's wearing pants anymore. But when he would sit down, he would tug on his pants leg. And he would wear the same suit for so long that he had literally worn through and there was a big hole in it. But he knew it was threadbare, but he didn't want to get rid of it because it was a suit. Anyway, so I'll fight you on the drapes.
That is funny.
I will fight you on the drapes. Okay, let's get you out with a few things. First and foremost, let's talk about David Kennerly. Because if David Kennerly hears about the show, we didn't talk about him.
Good thing he's not here, because we can say nice things about him. I mean,
we'd be on for another hour and a half if David Kennerly were on the show.
He wouldn't dare do that if he were here, because his head would be even more
exactly. David or Lewis, do you guys know David Kennerly at all?
Sorry?
I'm asking David and Lewis if they know David Kennerly.
I know the name. We're not in the same circles.
Well, there's no room in David Kennerly's circle.
Don't make me Google. Don't make me.
So Kennerly, I mean, Tori, as you well know, Kennerly is an incredible character, and he's actually quite a major character in The Gatekeepers.
Yes,
because he was always in the room with Gerry Ford. He was Gerry Ford's White House photographer, famously, and one of the great White House photographers. Which I would never say in his presence. But anyway, he contributed a lot of terrific photographs for The Gatekeepers and The Spy Masters.
Yeah.
We worked on 2 documentaries together, because as a friend of mine at the CIA likes to say, you know, I do this stuff backwards. I tend to do the documentary first and then write the book, which we did in both cases. President's Gatekeepers was our documentary on the White House chiefs, which Kennerly was a producer of. And The Spy Masters, CIA and the Crosshairs, was a documentary I did for Showtime with Kennerly and Jules and Gideon Naudé of 9/11 fame. And
yeah.
The great Susan Zirinsky, my pal Susan.
The great crew. David, I will go.
The American University's own Susan Zirinsky.
That's right.
A legend, yes.
David, one of the youngest ever to receive a Pulitzer Prize for photography, I believe, for his work in Vietnam.
I think. He was 24 or 25 when he...
Wow.
Yeah.
For a portfolio that included Frazier Ali at Madison Square Garden and all of his Vietnam stuff.
Yeah, he's a little bit like Forrest Gump. Anything important that happened, David was there, absolutely there, and front and center. We had Pete Souza on the show a year and a half ago, I guess, Obama's White House photographer, fabulous guy, fabulous book called Shade. And Pete embodied most White House photographers, or many photographers. They don't want to be the center of attention. They want to be in the background.
Yeah.
David, you know David's in the room.
Except for Kennerly, right.
Exactly. David is always in the room. Okay, there's that. Let's talk about The Gatekeepers for a minute, because it's a great book about White House chiefs of staff. We have a new White House chief of staff coming in. What do you think of Ron Klain? And what do you think is the number one priority, the most, the biggest challenge, the biggest problem he has to tackle right away?
I think Ron Klain is a superb choice, and put me down as somebody who wasn't sure it would be Klain, because he and Joe Biden had a falling out in 2016 when when Klain had his flirtation with the Hillary Clinton campaign before Biden was sure what he was doing. So I think it's a great choice by Biden. He'll be somebody who can tell hard truths to Biden. But they are up against, I think, the most daunting challenges of any administration in the last 50 years. A lethal pandemic,
agreed,
an economic crisis, racial unrest, global warming, the most polarized country since the Civil War. I wouldn't wish that on any chief of staff. And I think he's really got his work cut out for him. I think it'll sound funny to say that Biden made a rookie mistake, but I think that he did make a rookie mistake when he said that Kamala Harris would be the last person in the room on big decisions. It shouldn't be Kamala Harris. It should be Ron Klain. I don't care if you love Kamala Harris. The reason the White House chief should be the last person in the room is he's the only person whose agenda is the president's success and nothing else. That's the reason why Barack Obama would take the walk at the end of the day with Dennis McDonough, not Joe Biden, around the South Lawn. That's the reason why Jerry Ford would have Don Rumsfeld or Dick Cheney in the room when he made his final decision.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that he needs to be empowered, as to use one of Rumsfeld's rules. He needs to be empowered to execute Biden's agenda, or Biden will not succeed.
Yeah, I've always thought, and I've known a lot of chiefs of staff of White House, Pentagon, corporations, et cetera. And I would often say to them, your job isn't to make the president, the secretary, the CEO happy. Your job is to make them successful. And that very often means making them unhappy. It means telling them what they don't want to hear. That's really hard for people to do. But I think Ron's a great choice, by the way. I think based on his experience with Biden, based on the fact that Ron doesn't need the job, Ron doesn't need to build this into something else. I think he'll do a terrific job. An enormous respect for many different quarters.
Yeah. And again, I mean, not needing the job is a really
huge.
And the thing that Jim Baker and Leon Panetta had in common was that they were they'd been around the block. They were grounded. I mean, Baker was a 50-year-old Texas lawyer who didn't need to be chief of staff. Leon Panetta was they were grounded. They were comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah, that's huge.
They could tell him what he didn't want to hear.
Yeah, that's why we're so happy here on Chatter. We don't need anything else. Okay, so you've done The Gatekeepers, White House Chiefs of Staff. You've done The Spy Masters, Head of the CIA. What's next? And just unsolicited advice, don't do Secretaries of Agriculture. I don't think it'll be a good one right off the bat.
Well, I'm working on
I like the trend you're on, but
I'm working on another book, but you know that old saying in the intelligence community, I could tell you, but I'll come back when you have me back.
Only if you write a handwritten thank you note. Chatter on books, everybody knows. If you write a handwritten thank you note,
you
can come back. Yeah.
Notes are good.
Yes.
Really, really good and very, very personal.
I never wrote one myself, but
no, I hear they're very good.
So, but I didn't pronounce your last name.
The other great Rummy story, of course, just quickly, is the theory that George H.W. Bush believed for a long time, and I know you can see this one coming, is that Rummy decided to send Bush to CIA to end his career.
I know.
Send him into political exile. Well, Jim Baker and George H.W. Bush believed that for a long time. Now, the story that I believe is true is that, in fact, Elliot Richardson was going to be CIA director, and Kissinger said, over his dead body, and the result was okay, George H.W., come on home from China. That was how that happened.
Any talk about many people, whenever in government, whenever I hear these great conspiracies, I go, usually, I know these people. They are not capable of that. Exactly. They are not capable. Whenever I hear the U.S. government accused of conspiracy, you go, no, that could not happen. Absolutely could not happen. I'll tell you two things about Rumsfeld.
Rummy hated that story, as you know. I mean, he was.
Yeah, he didn't particularly love being called Rummy either. He didn't love that. So it can always kind of divide the world into those.
I never called him that.
He
was quite generous with me, by the way. He shared a lot of his unpublished snowflakes.
Oh, my God. 10 million snowflakes.
White House chief of staff. So.
Okay, this show is going way too long, but I'll tell the story anyhow. Did you know that I used to steal the snowflakes that he would send to me?
What are the snowflakes? Explain for
okay,
people.
So snowflakes
were liberals, actually, in this case.
Snowflakes were this incredibly efficient way Rumsfeld would get something off his plate, off his agenda, and onto yours. So and they were called snowflakes because he would send so many of them out that this they fell like email. Millions of snowflakes. Right. He didn't do email.
Long before email existed.
So, right. He would think to himself, you know, watching the news or something or other, Tory, we need to figure out why so-and-so said something or other, why Brian Williams said this was the greatest bombing since, you know, the start of World War II, when it was very different. And he would think that, and he would dictate it into his tape recorder, hand it to one of his assistants, and one of the assistants would immediately type it up on a piece of paper, two pieces of paper, you know, one and a copy. And one would come down to you as a snowflake. And there was always a reply by, you know, 2 minutes from now kind of thing. And the other one would go in a folder with your name on it. And it would go on the blackjack Pershing desk in his office, which, contrary to what Bob Woodward wrote in his book once, was never used for meetings. People didn't sit around that desk. It was just this massive thing in which Rumsfeld kept folders. And so the snowflake would come down to you. It would go in your folder. And so the next time you went into the secretary's office, you had something really important to discuss. He would go, let's look at your folder, shall we? And he would look through your list of snowflakes that he had sent you, and you either had responded, you hadn't. And it was remarkably efficient way to get crap off his desk, out of his mind, and onto yours, right? And sometimes the snowflakes were so challenging or so whatever, they were really... And sometimes you would think to yourself, he really doesn't need to be dealing with this at all. So long story short, there were often a fair number of people in Rumsfeld's office, or I would be in there when he wasn't there, perhaps. And I would look at my folder on his desk and I'm like, shit. And I would open it and I'd take snowflakes out. And so my folder would be empty. And so I would go into his office for something really important. Say it was before he was going to go brief the press. And I'd go in to brief him before he briefed the press. And he'd look at the folder and goes, oh, that looks pretty good. It's like, yes, sir. Absolutely. On top of everything, sir. So I would steal snowflakes off his desk, which is bad. So that's one story. And the other thing is, people love to talk about Rumsfeld fighting with this person, that kind of thing. There were two people in his entire time as Secretary of Defense with whom he would bother to have lunch one-on-one. He had very, very few one-on-one meetings and even fewer lunches ever one-on-one, a lot of official lunches. And the two people were Henry Kissinger, who was a mortal enemy in the Nixon Ford days, mortal enemies. They hated each other. One was Kissinger and one was George Tenet. And they spent an extraordinary amount of time together. And one time, I think this was pre 9/11, I came into Rumsfeld's office and he was very worked up about something. It was early afternoon. And I said, what's up? And he goes, I am so worried about George's budget, George Tenet's budget at the CIA, not the DOD budget, George's budget. And he, Rumsfeld, spent the next several weeks working tooth and nail to get the CIA budget increased, not his. And you do not see that happen. Most secretaries of anything are not out there working hard to get somebody else's budget. So,
well, yeah, and CIA was in Chapter 11 before Tenet came along. I mean,
yeah,
that was one of the things that he really rebuilt.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, last question, I promised to get you out. Who's going to be the new CIA director?
So... probably Gina Tenet is going to be gone one way or another, even if Donald Trump somehow has a second term, as Mike Pompeo has predicted.
Oh, please. Yeah.
I think she'll be gone. And there are a lot of contenders. Mike Morrell is obviously
right, good one.
Short list, really smart, a little bit like Bob Gates, you know, kind of a razor sharp analyst.
Uh-huh.
Who, worked his way up. I think Jeremy Bash is a contender, Leon Panetta's chief of staff at CIA. Really smart. Those are two names I hear a lot. Avril Haines is a contender.
Right.
Those are some of the names I've heard.
Cool. Well, Chris Whipple, the book, it really is fabulous. I mean, to make fun of everyone else who has interviewed you, who said it's actually a good read. Actually, is a word that should be eliminated from everybody's budget. It's a very good read. It's wonderful stories about some really, really important people. And it is as much about the presidents they served as them. So I really, everyone, go to Loyalty Books, go to your favorite local independent bookstore, go to bookshop.org, which is great, and buy The Spy Masters. And while you're at it, buy The Gatekeepers, because you might as well get steeped in all this. Chris Whipple, thank you so much for being with us. Stay
great
with us.
With
I've got a trick question for you at the end. A little bit of housekeeping, and then we do have a deserted island for tonight. So a little bit of housekeeping. If you listen to us on Apple iTunes, please go and review us. It's always nice to get nice reviews, and that actually helps us. Download us, follow us, send us emails, those kinds of things. We are back next week with our annual pre-Thanksgiving. It's not really about books, but it's kind of about a book show with Nevin Martell. And David, as I told you, Jeannie McManus is going to come back.
Yes.
Part of the original family, which will be great.
Love Jeannie.
Jeannie is great. Nevin Martell, Lewis, you probably know, is just an amazing guy. He is such a force in the DMV. He has written books about Calvin and Hobbes. He's written about Dave Matthews. He's written cookbooks. He's just this great raconteur. So we will have him back with us to talk about how to do Thanksgiving in the age of pandemic. And now Deserted Island, in honor of Chris Whipple, author of The Spy Masters, and the topic, if you were going to write a spy novel. Chris, you get to go last because I didn't tell you about this. If you were to write a spy novel, what would it be about? What would it be called? Lewis?
Well, living in the D.C. area, one meets spies.
As
a matter of course, really. You kind of like retired.
Oh, another one.
Yeah, exactly. What are you, an analyst?
Yeah.
But I've been mostly analysts, and they are, as you might expect, bureaucrats. And that's one of the things I love about John le Carré's spy fiction is how he repositions the Cold War as a struggle basically among bureaucrats. So my spy novel would be called GS-13.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I like that. The much maligned GS-13. I like that. David?
I have two working titles. One is The Lovely Drones. I don't know if that works out for me or not. And the other is I'm Sorry, That's Calcified. So I don't know. I'm going with one of those two. I'm not sure yet.
Wait, this is in honor of Norman Crosby's death that you're doing.
Exactly.
I love that. Okay, mine would be called Sex, Lives, and Dossiers. Because I truly believe, Chris can argue with me, but I truly believe that illicit affairs of all kinds have had pretty significant impacts on a lot of things that have impacted history, our country's geopolitics, and the spies just don't want to admit it because that just would seem too weak. But that's mine. Chris, if you're going to write a novel, which I hope you do someday, what would it be called?
I think I'd have to go with The Spy Masters. I don't know.
It's a good title.
Good for you. That sold at least 5 more books.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Lewis, David, Chris, thank you. Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend, as ever. Everybody, thanks for listening. Stay healthy, wear your mask, wash your hands, and we'll talk to you next week.